Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy, knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Jerry, it is the Hank Aaron episode of the podcast, episode 44. We are inside T-Mobile Park. It's going to be back in Seattle with you once again tonight. We are just hours away from the first of two exhibition games against the Padres. It's good to see you face-to-face. It's good to have everything in the rearview mirror except for 18 innings of baseball before opening day, Jerry.
Except for those things. You know, the fantastic trip to Japan, a really cool way to open up the 2019 season. Was a little nervous when we left Arizona, headed over and not quite knowing if we were ready from a pitching perspective to play two real games that mattered to the standings, but couldn't have been happier with the way things transpired.
Was it the best pizza in the world?
Unfortunately, I can't tell you.
No, what happened?
I experienced Korean barbecue, Japanese Wagyu steak, sushi that was as good as any I could even imagine. But on the night that I was scheduled to go to Syrianken Pizza, which is David Chang's pick for best pizza in the world, I had to go to a scheduled MLB function and cancel the plan. But Tim Laker, our hitting coach, and his wife went over, and I had to live vicariously through their images. It looked spectacular. He backed it up with it was, in fact, spectacular. Others on our team later made reservations and headed over. I was not able to get there. It's a hole in my life that I'm not sure how I'm ever going to be able to fill.
Well, do tell us about the sushi dinner that you had, or sushi lunch, right, that you had?
It was a lunch. We went over there. We had one day that was generally an off day. We did have an MLB function in the evening. So I scheduled a lunch with Ted Hyde, our ambassador scout to Japan. Ted's a great guy. Actually been here for closing in on 20 years with the Mariners, joined during the Pat Gillick administration, and is actually the scout credited with signing Ichiro. So it's a really fascinating, his career has come full circle, because shortly after joining the Mariners, he signed Ichiro. And he was part of that transition for guys like Kaz Sasaki, Kenji Jojima, from the MPB to the Mariners. And has been with the club all these years. He was there to see Ichiro off, and as well as our area scout there, Manny Noto, fabulous guy. And we went to Kuroso Sushi in Ginza, which is a place that we had been to once before a couple of years back. And the chef is the most entertaining guy you're ever going to be around, super high energy, and the quality of what he's putting out. I think I may have told you this before. He rolls in with a picnic basket full of his materials and just unloads the picnic basket and starts making sushi out of the picnic basket. The quality of the meat, he goes to the market each morning, to the fish market, the auctions, goes to the market and bids on what he thinks the best, you know, materials look like, and everything you're getting is that day fresh. It's phenomenal, off the charts. We tried so many new things. We ate nonstop sushi for about 2 hours, and by the time we got up, first my wife was begging for mercy, and when we walked out with a new lifetime friend, and Chef Caruso came to the opening game against the A's and joined us. He was bedecked in all kinds of Mariner gear, and we're hoping to fly him over to Seattle so he can repeat this sushi episode, and either here at T-Mobile Park or in my kitchen.
Is there a chance, Jerry, that this chef is now one spot higher on your favorites list, now above the Rays general manager? Like, is that the order of friendship we're talking about here?
I think we're clearly there. Yes. So much so that I wanted to find a way to smuggle him home. It's an awesome guy, super entertaining, and really one of, when you cross over the people that are just great at their craft, he is great at his craft.
Last couple of days were FanFest here at the ballpark, and Jerry, when we were doing a Q&A yesterday, we had a number of people thank you in particular for taking the time on the Wheelhouse, which was great to kind of meet some of the listeners. So a reminder, as always, if you're not subscribing, please be sure to do so. You can find it on Apple iTunes Store, on Stitcher, wherever you find your podcast. Subscribe, and we will be, of course, back at it like we were last year, getting these out to you on a pretty regular basis throughout the course of the season. Jerry, we have to talk about what is going to be remembered forever as one of the greatest send-offs this game has ever seen or will ever see in a game that does retirements and send-offs better than any sport. What was it like, your vantage point, of Ichiro in his final game playing in his native land?
Well, I've watched baseball all my life. You know, I can remember back to the mid-earliest 70s, and I've been a fan of the game to the nth degree. I've been involved in it now as a player and executive for 30 years. It is the single coolest night that I've ever experienced at a ballpark, bar none. It was awesome to watch. And, you know, we knew what was coming when the series began, so we had a bit of an advantage. And as you might have determined from watching what we did with Ichiro, you know, we pulled him out midway through game one just to provide a moment. And then the general idea was that we were going to double down with that on the second night and do the same thing midway through. But then lo and behold, Vogie got hit with a pitch in game one and was rendered unable to play in game two. So the answer to it was, you know what, we're going to roll with Ichi and just let him have this day. And it could not have been more the right thing to do, to the point that it was sometimes things work out even better than you'd hoped. We were hoping that it was just a tribute or an homage to a great player in really the most perfect of settings in his homeland. But the way it turned out, with how the crowd adored him, the fact that they dragged him back out of the clubhouse for the tour around the field, if your hair wasn't standing on end on your arm by the time that was over, or you were able to fight back tears if you were watching the emotion, not just of Ichiro, but of his teammates and the people in the stands. The thing that stood out to me most, other than how much the fans adored him, was the media who covers Ichiro every day. And some of the members of the media who follow the Mariners day in and day out have been following Ichiro for the entirety of his career, dating back to, you know, playing in Japan 25 years ago. And, you know, the emotion that you saw on their faces, there were many of them that were ready to shed tears, some that were, because they were seeing a moment they knew was kind of a life-changing experience. And it was. I will never forget it. I'm sure that not a single one of our players will ever forget it. And how many times already we've gone back and watched the footage that we drew from that night, because it was so riveting. You can't help but think, wow, I wish I would have ever had that effect on one person, much less an entire country.
Let's go back to game one. When he was pulled mid-game from right field, the crowd almost didn't know how to react. Is this simply something that is not done regularly in Japan?
Correct. So here in the United States, when you make the mid-game defensive change, you know what you're trying to achieve in that moment, or the fans know what you're trying to achieve in that moment, is bringing notoriety to the player that's leaving the field. The crowd was as quiet as could be as Ichiro was kind of wandering in from right field, is the best way to put it. And if not for the fact that his teammates gathered around the foul line, I don't know that anybody would have realized that he wasn't being pulled out of the game for a penalty. You know, we were trying to do is honor him, and I don't know that that was really the way it was received in the beginning until his teammates stepped up. And after that game, whether it was fans in the stands, and there were many fans, English-speaking fans, both native to Japan and traveling with the Mariners, or officials around the game, you know, people from MLB or the media who track us from Japan, had asked, is that the last time we'll see Ichiro? And that was not what we intended. So I thought, no, you will see him tomorrow. And tomorrow will be a fun night. And it really was. It was something, again, that I'll just never forget.
How much coordination went into the second game when he was lifted and we had the first of two incredible moments in the Tokyo Dome? The entire team leaving the field, heading over to the dugout. How much conversation that you know of happened with this? Was this just a very natural, organic thing for the guys to do?
I think Scott talked to a couple of the team leaders, you know, the veteran players, Jay Bruce, D. Gordon, guys that he knew would be on the field. And if I had to guess, D was probably the ringleader in making sure everybody was pulled together. And, you know, like you say, Kikuchi, D. Gordon had a very tough time with it emotionally because he's watching a great friend and a guy he's played with for the last 5 years walk away from the game. And everybody knows how much the game means to Ichiro and how hard and just how difficult this decision was for him. So there was a lot of emotion from his teammates as well. So when they got to the line, I think it was more Scott had a conversation with a couple of the veteran players and they took care of the rest. But I guess the choreography leading up to it was about 13 months in the making. This is something that we had talked about as early as last March when we signed Ichiro. And then even in May when we transitioned him into a, more of a consultants type role, this was always on the table as we will bring you to Japan and he'll be in the opening day lineup. So Ichiro knew last May that minimally he would play for these 2 days and he prepared for a long time to as diligently as a person or a human can focus on a single task. He was ready to go out there and do this. And, you know, I find what he did at his age to be remarkable. And I know he wanted to make this into another, you know, 27 years of baseball. But the fact that it ended as gracefully and really as memorable as it did is a tribute to Ichiro, because just like we've seen for so many years, you know, the Lou Gehrig speech or Cal Ripken running around the warning track, my guess is we're going to see this Ichiro footage for years and years.
There's kind of a circle of life element to Yusei Kikuchi making his first major league start the day that Ichiro plays in his final game, and the hug, the embrace between Yusei and Ichiro, obviously the tears is what we'll all remember from Kikuchi, but he didn't want to let go. This, we knew that he loved Ichiro. I don't think any of us knew that he was that impactful on him as a person and as a professional than what that one hug you could just see when you watched it.
He calls him Mr. Ichiro, which I think is awesome. And he means it in such an honest and genuine, respectful way. He loves Ichiro. And, you know, teammates love teammates. But for Yusei, I think it's a childhood hero. It is a guy he has looked up to and tried to pattern himself after in so many ways. So the way he carries himself on the field and the way in some ways he carries himself off. Has been driven by the way he's followed Ichiro. And he attached, it would look like Velcro was holding the two of them together. And I thought it was one of the coolest things, one of the coolest moments that I took away from that night. And even talking to Yusei after his outing and just going over and shaking his hand and giving him a hug, you know, congratulations, that's your major league debut, it's in the books. He still looks stunned. And I'm not sure he even remembered pitching in that moment. He was still thinking about the exit of Ichiro, which I think so many of us were.
Can you take us inside the clubhouse? What was it like in that moment in between the game ending and then Ichiro coming out for the curtain call, that time with his teammates?
Sat down, you know, Scott pulled the team together and the coaches, all of our staff that supports the club. And Scott talked about all of the accomplishments in Ichiro's career, the 10 All-Stars, the 10 Gold Gloves, the MVP, the Rookie of the Year, and then set Ichiro up to stand up and speak to his teammates. And after one really funny moment that I'll let remain private because it was quite funny, I laughed out loud. But Ichiro said something very subtle that really didn't reference all the years in playing or really how much he loved the game. He talked about his teammates and dated back to teammates he had in the MPB and then walked on through his time with the Mariners up to and including this group. Didn't single out players by name, talked about them in groups and how much those people had an effect on his life. And I think even talked about the way he had grown as a teammate in his time from the first time he was with the Mariners to this episode, this entry with the Mariners. And it was amazing how much he could say in just 2 minutes of addressing the team, and everybody left there feeling impacted. And at this time, by the time this was going down, you could feel the stadium. We're underneath the stadium. You could feel the stadium shaking over our head while the fans were all starting to jump up and down, and they were chanting his name. And they chanted for 15 minutes straight before Ichiro ran out and went on what we now know to be his final tour on the field, which was not part of the original plan. It just happened organically, which made it even really, which made it even cooler.
Colin, I have to ask you, you were part of the Ichiro paparazzi who was a part of this, and the Mariners' social media hit it out of the park. Fantastic work by you, Nathan Rauschenberg as well. What was this like for you to witness?
It was unbelievable. One of the coolest things for me going all the way back to about the kind of the beginning of the game is reports started to break on Twitter. I think the Japan Times had it first and then Olney had it shortly thereafter and eventually became part of the broadcast. But one of the interesting things was to see from at bat to at bat to at bat the level of awareness that this was it. His first at bat to his, I think it was his second when the initial reports broke, just a whole different tenor in the audience and the crowd. And then with the final one, everybody was fully aware that this all but certainly was the final at bat of his career. And just the atmosphere there was unbelievable. And when he got pulled out, I mean, you're walking past people, you know, bawling their eyes out, and it's understandable. I mean, we kind of, speaking of social media, we kind of split up duties where I was up in the crowd and kind of the press box, and Nathan was down by the dugout. And I was even thinking, yeah, sure, I'd love to be down by the dugout, but if I'm down by the dugout and I see Yusei Kikuchi break down the way that he did, I'm not going to be able to hold it together either. So it was, yeah, it was one of the coolest things, sports or otherwise, that I have ever seen in my life. It was incredible.
It's hard. I was thinking about it the other day. There isn't another player in the game right now, or even if you zoom out the last 5, 10, 15 years, who means as much to, well, forget the country, even to their own city, right, as Ichiro means to Japan. You look at, you canvas the superstars that we've seen in this game for the last 20 years. I mean, right, Jerry? I mean, Griffey is there. I mean, Griffey transcended. But Griffey doesn't mean as much to somebody in Collins, Wisconsin, right, as what Ichiro means to every corner of Japan.
He's the most popular Japanese baseball player in history. And I think what that means to the game globally, first of all, baseball is huge in Japan. And, you know, the Pacific Rim in general, it's a giant, whether it's Korea, it's South Korea, it's Japan, it's Taiwan. It's such a big impact on life in general. And he's the biggest star. Ichiro is the biggest star and has been for a quarter century. And he goes by one name, which all the greats, right? It's amazing how big an impact he's had on the game in that region. I'll also say that I thought about this a lot because so much reflection while you're sitting there watching, and you know what's happening. Because, again, we had the advantage of knowing that this was going to be the final two exhibition games and two regular season games for Ichi. But I think maybe the most unique baseball player of all time, or at least since Babe Ruth. Because if you think about the Babe Ruth, and I'm going to get all historical on you here, but if you think about the Babe Ruth impact, Babe Ruth was so unique in his time, transitioned from pitcher to slugger, and was hitting 60 homers while the people around him were hitting 19 or 20, you know? And a second place finisher to Babe Ruth in the home run race might have trailed him by 30 homers. In a given year. He was just so much different than the other players around him, and that transcended his time. Ichiro, very, very similarly, came from Japan at the age of 27, threw up a 3,000-hit career as a Major League Baseball player in addition to what he did playing in the MPB, and did it as a contact and speed-oriented defense-first type player in an era where everybody was Babe Ruth, you know? So everybody's bombing, and Ichiro's out there doing these more Ty Cobb-ish type things with contact, high speed, 500 stolen bases, 3,000 hits, hit 300 every year. And it was a phenomenal thing that made him a very unique player, not just in his time, but really in a century. That it just stood out as unique. And I don't know why I thought about that context while I was watching him run around in Tokyo. But, you know, to see him play at the height of his powers, it was awesome because he dominated a game that was made up of people who were doing it with high power, and that's really not what Ichiro did.
There's a pretty decent argument that you can make that on a global stage, Ichiro is the most popular baseball player that has ever played. You could make that argument, which is just absolutely unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, just going back and forth with people on Twitter, probably being a little more pointed than I should be. People were, you know, getting fussy about, you know, why Ichiro's playing these games, why he's getting this many at-bats. And sure, we went 2-0, which is always nice. But, you know, the key point is, you know, it's not really for the people in Seattle. It's not so much for Mariners fans, though many love to send him off the way that they did. You know, it's for baseball fans at a global level. And that moment was just, there's never been anything like it, and I'm not sure there ever will be.
And I'd say this, Colin, in addition to being about giving to the fans at a global level, you know, and not just our Mariner fans. We love the Mariner fans. This was also about giving to Ichiro. And I can tell you that there was a concern on Ichiro's part that these games would be – these games mattered. And, you know, how he felt, I guess, on the spot that he wasn't producing and did we want to play him in these games. And our thought was the two games in Japan, you know, whether they were regular season games or not, they didn't mean as much to the Mariners as Ichiro did. And I think that means something globally as well. You know, we're going to win 70, 80, 90 games, whatever the number is. We're going to win that number of games. If two games are pulled aside as a tribute to one of the great players in the history of your organization, who is also one of the great players in the history of baseball, it's the right thing to do. And you'd like it to end with a four-hit day and a homer in his final at bat, and he gets to walk out like Ted Williams, but it doesn't really work that way. The fact that we were able to unwittingly set up a scenario where he had an opportunity in the last bat of his career to single through the middle and put the go-ahead run across home plate, that moment happened. And, you know, it didn't take away from the magic that happened afterward, that he didn't come through in the batter's box. But the fact that he was standing there made all of it worthwhile.
What is next for Ichiro within the organization?
You know, we're going to sit down this week and meet with Ichiro and Alan Turner, who's Ichiro's confidant and his interpreter, and we're going to talk about what comes next. He will always be a part of the Mariners family, and we want him to be a part of what we do on a daily basis, from mentoring and onboarding young players, which he has really developed a knack for, in my opinion, over these last couple of years, maybe even dating back to his time at the Marlins. We want him to be involved in all the things that we do on the Pacific Rim, particularly in Japan, working with Ted Hyde, who he has a very close relationship with, in developing our reach in the Far East. We also want to make sure that whether it's base running, it's outfield play, or it's hitting approach, or it's even the day-to-day rigor of dealing with the game, as we transition to a younger team, the voice of experience that he brings and the ability to observe. I've said before out loud, this guy has the highest baseball IQ of any player I've ever known. It's off the charts good. His perception, what he picks up, and the way he can make it simple is extraordinary. So we can learn a lot from him, and we intend on taking as much advantage of that as he's willing to lend us with his time.
There were two games that were played, and the Mariners were 2-0.
Yeah.
It was nice to see the wins come along with all the fanfare for Ichiro. What was your biggest takeaway or takeaways in those two games, those wins against the A's, about the ball club in general in 2019?
Well, kind of like we've talked about on this podcast or throughout, you know, we have talked about, you know, taking a step back in 2019 with an eye toward winning in 2020, 21, and beyond. This team that we're putting on the field is a fun team to watch. And I think the two games in Japan, even the exhibition games we played against the Tokyo Giants, were this team is fun to watch. And this team is better than people are giving it credit. I don't think, I've said before, this is not a 100-loss club. We have a very good offense. We can score runs, and we can do it very quickly. We can do it with speed. We can do it with power. We can do it by getting on base. And there's so many different elements up and down that lineup. We saw all of that play out during our time in Japan. You know, we saw two young pitchers, a 27-year-old lefty and two 27-year-old lefties, as it works out. And they both do it in a different way. But they give us a nice foundation to build on. And, you know, I thought the fact that Marco was able to, what I called a character game, he was able to dig in and kind of grab himself after starting off and teetering in the first couple of innings. Once we scored him the runs, he did what winning pitchers do. He stepped up and he let his character drive it. And even though it was not the best stuff or command that Marco's had during his time with the Mariners, he took his first opening day start and he rose up and effectively, you know, allowed maturity to carry him through and give us a win. And then we got to see the electric stuff that Yusei Kikuchi brings to the table. And, you know, he went into that game under the weather. He was kind of sick that day. I don't know if you noticed how much he was sweating when he was out there, but he went in with a higher fever, and he had been kind of under the weather for the last week before that. Had never said anything about it, but he had to really grind through and to throw 90 pitches and give us a chance to win that second game by just making big pitches when he had to. That really encouraged me. And then the way our bullpen stepped up, particularly I would point to two performances. One, Hunter Strickland both nights I thought was outstanding, and we're seeing upper 90s with a real wipeout slider and a lot of confidence when he's coming out of the bullpen. And the job that Matt Festa did in game two really can't be undersold. Because that might be, you know, with the coming return of Anthony Swarzak, with Hunter Strickland throwing the way he is right now, with Zach Roskopf, when Zach is on the mound and healthy, he is as dominant a strikeout pitcher as any left-hand reliever in the game, truly. And Corey Guerin, we know, is a steady influence down there. We needed one of that young group of relievers to step up and take the baton, so to speak, and run with it. And Matt Festa's first outing of 2019 was really encouraging from that perspective.
You bring up Swarzak, timetable on him?
We're expecting him to be with us when we travel to Chicago for our first road trip. So he is currently throwing roughly an inning every second or third day down in Arizona. He's doing it all versus minor league competition. So we didn't want to start his clock any earlier than we had to. But, you know, he will, for all intents and purposes, if there are no setbacks, he'll join us in Chicago for that first road trip.
You brought up Hunter Strickland. Speaking with him the other day at FanFest, and he was talking about how he'd always been a power pitcher. He's always had this great fastball. But in recent time, he has really, as he put it, developed this knack for his slider to become a wipeout pitch. That must have been a part of the evaluation process when you decided to sign him to come to Seattle. How have you seen that pitch impact him, especially in these early days with the Mariners?
You know, Strick, for the last 2 years, had shown, let's say, a trend or a decline in his velocity. And as his velocity declined, he was a little bit more apt to use his slider. And when I say his velocity declined, it declined from 100 to 95. And, you know, what we saw at the tail end of last year was maybe his lowest velocity as a major leaguer. He was sometimes 92, 95. And his breaking ball had really good spin, but not a great deal of efficiency in its location. So when he came into to camp, those were the two things effectively that we handed him. He came in great shape, first of all. Like they all do, the greatest shape of their lives.
Every year.
And but he did come in great shape, and he came in with his old fastball. He's touched three digits. He's been operating roughly 96, 97 miles an hour in each of the outings that he's had. And we were able to work with him on maybe refining that slider and refining the usage, the amount of times we'll use that slider. So now instead of being a pitch he throws 30-35% of the time, maybe we turn up the dial on the percentage of that, which could in theory, make both it and the fastball better pitches because they're coming at more of an equal spread. So, you know, we talked to Hunter about this when we were courting him to come here as a free agent, that there were some ways we thought we might be able to help him take a step forward. And you know, lo and behold, he helped us take a huge step by showing up with the Hunter Strickland circa 2012-14 velocity, not necessarily what we were seeing last year as he was battling kind of health issues.
Sounds like some really good news on the Malik Smith front. Apparently, Malik is a Mariner. We haven't seen Malik. We've heard him in the background. We've seen him in the clubhouse. But there's good news against these games against the Padres for Malik.
And Malik will be running around out
there. That's good. We're excited to see that. Tell us about Malik.
Malik Smith, to me, Malik is one of the most exciting Mariners. He's a speed, fun, energetic, athletic player. And he'll be out there in center field tonight against the Pods and again tomorrow. And our goal right now is to play him 5 innings tonight and 7 tomorrow and have him ready to go opening day. His reward for this long rehab will be, yes, that is true, a start off against Chris Sale as a left on left. But Malik has on base skills. He has that top of the range type of speed. You know, on a scouting grading scale of 20 to 80, it's 80 speed. He can really haul. Very athletic player, has a very good idea of the strike zone, understands how to manage an approach day to day and his at bats, has been a really productive major league player in the batter's box, and we feel like he's just scratching the surface of what he can do. He's just turned 26 years old. So we feel like Malik gives us the ability to feature kind of that young speed orientation at the top of the lineup. And I think the combination of he and D. Gordon, particularly on the bases, and as you saw when we were over in Japan, a healthy D. Gordon is a fun D. Gordon. And how disruptive he was on the bases. Frankly, our winning rally was created because D. got on base. Not the fact that he didn't go out there and steal the base. He distracted the Oakland pitcher to such a degree that he created a rally. Mitch drew a walk as a result, and then all these good things started happening, or was hit by a pitch. But the all these good things started happening because D. Gordon was on base. And I do think that the combination of those two players gives us a fun speed element to go with what we think is good power, with guys like Haniger and Santana and Bruce and Encarnacion and Healy. And gives us a nice mix in our lineup. But really glad he's back. He's probably one of the more entertaining new Mariners, and unfortunately we've not really been able to see him in a Mariner uniform.
You have been able to make this one of the youngest teams in the majors this over the course of this offseason, and it figures to get younger over the course of the season with the depth that has been created in the farm system. As you and Scott and Annie McKay, who oversees the farm system for the Mariners, as this season progresses, how do you guys go about deciding when the right time is to bring some of these younger guys up, like a Justice Sheffield that we saw in spring training and we know will be a part of the Mariners' future probably sooner rather than later?
Well, the point is we would like it to be sooner rather than later, but we want to make sure that when each of these guys – we don't have a specific criteria for the group. We do have a specific criteria for each player. And that'll remain for each of those players. The one thing that we would like to see each one of them do, whether it's Eric Swanson, Justice Sheffield, it's J.P. Crawford, even going on down to Double A. You know, it could be Braden Bishop, it could be Jake Fraley, it could be Kyle Lewis, et cetera. Justin Dunn, who was fabulous in spring training. Each of them has a specific criteria that will define whether they move up to the next level. And our goal is that by the time we get to the midpoint of this season, that we've already infused some of that younger talent on the major league club. Guys like Eric and Justice and JP might be a little bit tougher with Bish because we are older in the or more, I guess, complete in the outfield with Mitch and right and Malik in center and Domingo in left. They're all, 26, 26, 28. And, you know, Bish is going to have to work his way in there more likely as an extra guy than getting regular reps. So, you know, but not so with the pitching and with JP. Our thought is when they clear the road, when they tell us it's time, we're just going to make space for them and it's their time.
I feel really good about you today on Stump JD.
Really?
And I hope you feel that way as well.
Please, can we make this an Ichiro question? Because I'm really good at that right now.
How many hits does Ichiro have? So, baseball, there's so many great things about numbers in baseball, but streaks. Streaks are so great, right? I love monitoring streaks. Now, O'Keefe is already, I mean, like, look at this guy over here.
Who has the most consecutive foul balls?
That's what it'll be.
Yeah.
Somebody facing Max Scherzer is what I'm guessing the answer.
O'Keefe. Okay, so streaks are a beautiful thing. I was disappointed, as we all were, to see Kyle Seager injured because it meant that his franchise record six consecutive opening day starts at third base has come to a close. No third baseman in franchise history has made six consecutive starts. Seager has. So that did make me think, okay, there's got to be the longest streak for a third baseman with one team. Because we're talking legacy here. Legacy with one team, one market, one franchise, one city. So let's look at third baseman in particular, Jerry. And I think your historical knowledge, which is, you know, an 80 out of 80 here. I feel good. Yeah, I feel good about you here. Tell me which third baseman made the most consecutive opening day starts for a single team.
I'm going to go with Brooks Robinson.
Yes, see, I knew you would be all over
it. The no-brainer, then.
Okay, it's extra credit. Do you want to take a stab at how many years?
I'm going to say the first was 1958.
Oh, you're so close.
57.
I would have taken total years in a row,
1957, by the way. And the last was 1976.
The last was...
He played in 1977. I don't have his game log open to see if he started on opening day in 1977.
It was the 1976. It was not his final year. It was his second to final year. It was 20 consecutive years he started for the Orioles at third base, which is amazing.
Phenomenal. And I know from having been a pretty avid baseball card collector during my lifetime, and the fact that Brooks Robinson was always, I never had a baseball card that featured Brooks Robinson as anything but a Baltimore Oriole. And I will say this, of all the players that I won't even profess to having grown up watching the great Brooks Robinson during his heyday, because it was just a little before my time, but of all the people I've met in baseball in this phase of my life, none of them are a better person than Brooks Robinson. Just an awesome guy to spend time around. Very Stan Musial-like. I will throw Stan Musial into that category.
I appreciate that.
But Brooks Robinson is just...
He is my Tom Seaver.
He's a prince of a human being.
I can believe it. I did look up, by the way, speaking of Stan Musial and the Cardinals, I looked up the game log for Brooks' first opening day start in 1957. It was against the Washington Senators. And Whitey Herzog was the center fielder for the Senators, the Hall of Fame manager for the Cardinals, which is just weird to see Herzog as a player, right? Because you only think of him as Whitey Ball and the manager.
And he looked exactly
the same.
He looked
exactly the same. Well, I knew you would get this question right, Jerry. Congratulations. I wanted to really – I didn't want you going to opening day over. You know, I wanted you to feel good about
yourself. You threw me a cookie. I like it. Believe me, I appreciate it. I need one every now and then.
Let's get to some listener questions. Remember, you can always email the podcast, thewheelhouse@mariners.com. Let's see, K Bev on Twitter. Which under the radar prospect, Jerry, opened the most eyes this spring training?
Jake Fraley, no brainer. And I say that fully understanding that Jared Kelenic, Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Lewis, Evan White, Justin Dunn, Justice Sheffield, far more mainstream than Jake Fraley was. There's even Shed Long was tickling the back end of top 100 lists and widely considered to be one of the top 10 both in our organization and with the Reds. Jake Fraley came in largely anonymous to our spring training camp and left a really strong first impression, both with the major league staff, with our front office, and really I think with our fan base. The fans that were down there and watched him day to day, this is a super athletic player. He does things the right way. He's got a great approach at the plate, very mature in the batter's box. He can play all three outfield positions, and we feel like he's above average at any of them. Runs well. He's a smart base runner. And I think what we were shocked, I guess what stood out the most was how much power there is in Jake's game. You're not talking about a center fielder with spray it around skills and more of a speed game. This is a guy who can hit the ball over the fence and do it with some regularity. Very exciting young prospect.
But the speed sprayed around, that was kind of the book on him when he was drafted out of LSU, right?
It was going to be a defense-oriented speed player who frankly, if the bat comes, that's a bonus. Well, in our minds, the bat has come in a big way. And you know, although he cooled down a little bit toward the tail end of his time in the big league camp, you know, just seeing him again out here over the weekend taking BP during the Fan Fest, it's an exciting skill set, and I know everyone left spring training with thumbs pointing up on Jake Fraley.
With a guy like Jake, do you tell your guys to go out and find us a Mitch? Because the parallels, fans are quick to point it out. You know, the high number, the little old for high A, but dominates it for extenuating circumstances. Yeah, it's interesting how there are parallels there. You don't want to slap that label on anybody, but an impressive prospect nonetheless.
I'm going to give credit where it's due. So it is something that we do. It's frankly part of how we found Mitch. And although we did not have this in place at the time, but we're always looking for that guy, that, you know, the stone that nobody was willing to look under, the guy who might be looked past because he was a little old for his level, or the former high round pick who's taken a little bit longer to get through a system than some do. You know, we're constantly looking at that type of player. And one of our analysts, Ben Aronow, runs what we have kind of created internally as a skill change report. And on a regular basis, Ben sends out a blast where he's letting us know through an analytic lens based on TrackMan information and the data he's pulling off of it, if there are any skill changes in the game that we need to be aware of. So-and-so is hitting the ball markedly harder. This guy is hitting the ball in the air at a considerably, you know, greater rate than he used to. Pitchers are creating better spin on a breaking ball, et cetera. And he'll do this update fairly regularly. And it just so happened that for a couple of months, Jake Fraley was one of our skill change guys. And when we got engaged in the discussions with Tampa, and the number of names we were discussing exceeded just Mike Zunino and Malik Smith, we immediately asked for Jake Fraley. And honestly, right there with Chef Caruso for me is Eric Neander of the Rays. And he said, you know, we are not really sure what we have in Fraley. I said, neither are we, but we're really intrigued. So, you know, they knew that they had something, and we feel like it was something pretty special. And it's better than maybe we even expected, at least the up close and personal. Sure looks that way.
And do you remember, I know this was a while ago at this point, what that skill change was? Was it an exit velo, a ball in the air more?
All of those things. He was hitting the ball in the air more. It was at a higher velocity, and he was creating more impact off the barrel. So his exit velos, his hard hit rates were up considerably. And we measure certain things. We measure 90-plus mile-an-hour exit, and then we measure 100-plus exit velocity off the barrel. And I think his 100-plus mile-an-hour exit velo was up something in the neighborhood of 30 or 40%. It was a considerable jump, and I think if you looked at last year's numbers, with the exception of the obvious, which are guys like Nelson Cruz and Mitch Haniger, Jake Fraley's hard hit off the barrel balls measured up against the best that we had in our organization, big leagues included.
This next question is an interesting one. It comes from Josh in Seattle. Those who haven't seen it yet, you'll notice whether you come out to the ballpark or you watch games on television, there is a beautiful new brick backstop right behind home plate. He wants to know, will the new backstop be a challenge of any way, the ball caroming off there? Will that impact the game in your eyes at all compared to, for those who don't remember, it's kind of the green padded wall that just blended in before?
I think you're almost surely going to see more than a couple over the – and I don't think it's going to be a weekly thing by any stretch. You will see a couple of multi-base wild pitches where you get the ball. Like, for instance, I'll flash back to the first two games we played against Oakland, in particular a pitch that Dan Altavilla threw where Omar Narvaez looked something akin to like Ken Dryden back there just spreading, trying to attack the ball. And I think it might have made it to the backstop on a fly. The padding on the wall tends to swallow those balls up, and you'll limit the runner to one extra base. With the brick back there, you're not going to be able to determine which way the ball is going to carom. Just depends on how it hits the brick. You'll see this in Pittsburgh, where they have something similar, St. Louis, where they have something similar. And it does create a little bit of an extra carom. And as a result, a couple of times a year, we might see a runner go from first to third on a wild pitch. But hopefully it's pro Mariner, not anti.
It can always play in your favor, right? If you have a wild pitch and a runner at third base and the ball gets to the backstop, we've seen it where it comes right back to the catcher and the runner at third base is thinking this is never going to get to him in time. And all of a sudden, there's a tag with no sweat and the runner's out.
I think that's also, let's call it a hidden benefit of our brick wall.
I know you guys certainly have ran all the analytics and all the numbers on that. Jerry, I know you are swamped. You got a ton of stuff going on, but this has been a blast to catch up with you in advance of opening day, which of course is Thursday night, Thursday late afternoon against the Red Sox. Pre-game festivities begin at 3:30. Macklemore will be giving a performance in the T-Mobile pen. Of course, Edgar's throwing out the first pitch, red carpet introductions. First college night of the season is the next night on Friday. $14 view-level seats. Get those at mariners.com/college. So we got a ton of stuff coming up. Jerry, thank you for the time, and we cannot wait for the fact that opening day is almost here.
I can't wait either. Believe me, I am in for another opening day.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.